There is just one yoga. Imagine it as a big mountain. And you can go through the mainstream pathway. You can go through your own pathway. You can crawl, you can run, jump all the way to the top. You know, you can go on your handstand. It's just your choice. Later in your life, you start to discover things. What is your karma in this life? What do you need to push through on your spiritual quest? Yoga is universal and many people connect to yoga. But the more there is, the harder it is to find a very original and meaningful practice. Exposed to so much and such a big sea of information, somehow this secret, more refined and enriching practice, it's harder to find these days. Thanks to Simon and to other teachers also that I found along the way, there's still these bright lights. For me, I feel like it's about discovering my way and then also following some of the very individual teachers. Walking together for a while, together on the yogic quest, to also go separate ways. Yoga, for me, it's not just about being in the comfort and loving myself, but it's through the discomfort that I find the love towards myself and to not only feel like I'm separated on my yoga mat doing my thing, but actually through my practice finding how to connect through everything to everything that is around me.
So welcome back to this podcast, and this week I'm really happy to be introducing Malvina, who likes to be known as Malva of Malva Yoga. She's freelance professional yoga teacher and graphic designer and illustrator as well, originally from Poland, but she also studied in Dublin in Ireland. She spent a great deal of time in Barcelona and established a great business there, communicating yoga through events, through retreats and festivals. And now she's landed in Mallorca and running retreats again, just finished one recently. In brief, when I just asked Malva what her approach to yoga was, which we're going to go into more detail now, is personalized approach to yoga to meet individuals' needs, which is really beautiful and I resonate with. So welcome, Malva.
Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really an honor and a pleasure to figure now here on your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you too. Yeah. The feeling is mutual. It is. It's an honor when we come together and discuss these matters, which we both care really deeply about.
Yes, I actually found you first through Instagram, and not oftentimes that I find this medium as interesting to find new people, but for once it worked, and I was very surprised and positively surprised. So thanks to Instagram.
Yeah, totally. Like, thanks for reflecting that. I agree too. I've had some great connections through Instagram. It's quite a surprise. And because I guess it's like such a big machine and it's so visual and by its nature superficial. So it sort of seems like this really like sort of showy thing. But voice notes, you know, like it's such a game changer when you start to develop a connection with someone. It's like comments here and there, likes, and then it's like send a voice note, and all of a sudden you're like humans having a conversation. It's so nice to start there, and I'm really delighted too that we're now face to face having a conversation. And I really enjoyed our brief chat when we were organizing what we were going to do. And well, we went into a lot of detail when we chatted, and you were just starting to get into what personalized yoga means to you. So I wonder if you'd like to just delve into that a little bit more to get us started.
Yeah. So basically, just to mention that we found each other through also our teacher, Simon, which I find as a great guide into yoga. And, you know, this is something what I found over time, is that now yoga is very popularized. Okay, now yoga is very wide and universal, and many people connect to yoga. But the more there is, the harder it is to find also a very original and meaningful practice. You know, I feel that this is a little bit lost along the lines. once we are exposed to so much and such a big sea of information, somehow this kind of a secret, more refined and enriching practice, it's harder to find these days. So thanks to Simon and to other teachers also that I found along the way, yeah, there's still these bright lights in the universe, and even you can find them through Instagram.
Oh, I'm tingling listening to you speak like this now. It's so nice, because it does, there's that word secret is so auspicious in the world of yoga, isn't it? Where it's like, oh, there's secret practices, and you're like, oh, what are those secret practices? And it's like, it's kind of, it's right there in front of you, but there's such subtlety to it, it can be really easily missed.
Exactly, yes. And it's harder and far harder to find those teachers. Definitely, it's important to find them before they are gone. So this is a kind of a inner quest that I'm on, is to connect to teachers that are still around and to practice before they're, you know, gone, to practice with them.
Wow.
To take as much knowledge as it's possible and then pass it on to the next generations.
I think we'll have a lot of Anglo-Saxon listeners, by the way, and me and Melva both share an origin in the Eastern European genetics, and because of that, I imagine we might go into some sort of like black comedy, like, sort of, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, oh my god, talking about before the dead. But it's you know, I think the yogis align with some certain Eastern European values that are like, you know, let's be realists, the corpse is coming, the corpse pose is at the end of your class, that's preparing you for
exactly,
we're all on a time limit.
Shavasana, the most important pose of the whole practice is Shavasana. How are we gonna give the last breath away?
Such a profound thing. And the yogis, of course, like, so much talk on, like, you have a limited number of breaths. That itself is a reminder that, you know, mortality is what we're doing here. We're playing the game of what can we do in the precious time that we have. And the yogis talk about that breath count. And thank you so much for bringing in Simon into the talk. And we're going to talk on a few other teachers as well. I think Shandor Ramit's going to appear in here, and Master Yang. I'm really excited to hear from you, because I know you have a unique insight and experience with these amazing master teachers as well. So yeah, it feels really right to mention that there is a huge ocean of knowledge to which we are able to just paddle in the surface. And I feel to honor the traditional teachers and how these so-called secret teachings have somehow been present and somehow managed to find their way through an impossible set of circumstances into the mainstream, and to actually, like you say, get through all of the widespread, like, you know, superficial, like, surface layer, you know, you got to dig deep. It really sunk to my soul when you said, I'm on an inner quest. I was like, yeah, you are. And I really feel like I am too, you know, so I can really resonate so strongly with that idea of an inner quest. And I think that a great teacher will show you that's where you're looking. You know,
yeah,
like, you're looking around for teachers, but you remember you're on an inner quest
for sure.
So how do you know that? How have you come to realize that you're on an inner quest?
For me, actually, the practice of yoga became, well, it called me because of the mystic part of it. I was doing contemporary dance when I was younger, so I had a flexibility in the body. I had a lot of, you know, strength, and the movement was always there. But actually, what I wanted to experience was more the mystic part. Also, coming from post-communistic Poland, where, you know, there's just church as an opportunity to find spirit. I was in my rebel times, around 13, 14, 15 years old. And what called me the most was yoga. We had this one teacher called Renata Kobe, which was a Iyengar teacher. And so, of course, when I went to her classes, it was physically not challenging for me. But what I loved was her presence, her, like, chanting mantra to us, the opening mantra for the Iyengar class. And every time she would chant, I just got shivers, you know, all over my body, but like this positive shivers. And you're like, oh yes, I'm in the right place in the right time. This is it.
Wow.
And also the whole kind of like seriousness of it, the the feeling that I'm actually doing something that I don't can't explain through words, but I felt much more connected there than I did in a church, let's say, on a Sunday mass, you know, when there is, like, especially in Poland, when there is all this pretentiousness, you know, like wearing clothes just to impress your neighbors and things like that on Sunday morning. I was really not drawn to that, and I felt like I'm just wasting my time standing there on this Sunday mass. But on the yoga class, I actually started to feel, okay, well, actually the calmness, the silence, the breath, the simple things that nobody else pays attention to were the things that amazed me. And I really wanted to go just to these classes to chant an om over and over again. And that was at the beginning for me, the place where I really connected. And later in my life, I went through Ashtanga practice, Anusara, Bikram, to finally land in the arms of shadow yoga in Ireland, in Dublin. And this was a beautiful experience because, again, after doing more like a mainstream yoga, you know, I was looking for stepping out of my comfort zone, basically. And every time I got even in Ashtanga to a place where I felt it's just becoming too much about the body, about another posture, another place in the sequence, conversations with the so-called sangha, the people that also come to the classes where, you know, we would go for coffee after class and it would always be like, where are you in the series or something like this. And I felt that's not actually what yoga is about, right? It's not about this competition with yourself. And then it's a very fine line in Ashtanga to fall into that kind of competition with your own self. So again, I was thinking, no, I need to go somewhere else. I need to do something else where this is not my main point of practice. And when I encountered shadow yoga, that was like a big game changer, because I felt, okay, this is where I again feel challenged, but it's this silence within, is this place of discipline, is this kind of more like martial arty approach, which I was longing for. And I don't know if it comes from my Polish background or what is it that I do feel, you know, that yoga for me, it's not just about being in the comfort and loving myself, but it's through the discomfort that I find the love towards myself, and to not only feel like I'm separated on my yoga mat doing my thing, but actually through my practice, finding how to connect through everything to everything that is around me outside of my yoga mat, and to bring that calmness from the practice into the everyday life chaos.
Thank you for the share. That's a powerful journey, and it brings me to a few questions. And yeah, thanks so much for that amazing share. There's a few things that I'm really interested in from that, and I love the fact that you're bringing in shadow yoga and that there's a challenge to it, because I'm curious about it. It's not something I know much about, but I know that there is an association between Simon and Shandor. You told me that Shandor was Simon's teacher for a time, and I'm interested if you want to share any more about that. Yeah, just to reflect as well, I've been to like one Anusara workshop, and I found it quite interesting with a sort of like Iyengar approach. And I've practiced a lot of Ashtanga as well, got really into Ashtanga for a couple of years. And I too had an experience where, although there was great intentions for people to be on that inner quest, you know, starting those conversations with people, it felt like there was a bit of a brick wall, because there was so much emphasis and focus on the physical aspect of the challenge of the physical. And I like the fact that you overcame it so much, and that because of your dancing background, I presume, you know, you'd really like sort of been through your paces physically, and you'd identified that as something separate from your spiritual discomfort and evolution. You mentioned Om as well. Was that the chant that your Iyengar teacher gave you before the sessions, or did she chant something more specific? Because I know that there's a chant for Iyengar.
Yeah, we did actually the Iyengar chant, and the Om was just something that we'd always, you know, do anyways. And yeah, it was just this first time that I didn't even know why I'm chanting Om, but it just totally made sense. And later in your life, you start to discover things, no? And you realize the meaning behind it, and you're like, ah, now I know why I liked it so much. But what I would like to say about the these different practices and different methods is what I realized over time is, first of all, there is just one yoga, right? And there are just different ways of getting there. I imagine it as a big mountain called yoga. And then you have all these different pathways that you can get to the top of the mountain. And you can go through the mainstream pathway, and it's totally fine. You can go through your own pathway, take the machete and cut some bushes on the way, and then make your own way. You can crawl, you can run, you can jump all the way to the top. Like, you just call it. You can go on your handstand. You can walk all the way up on the hands, you know. It's just your choice. What do you need to experience? What is your karma in this life? What do you need to, let's say, push through on your spiritual quest? And for me, I feel like it's a bit about going through the bush and discovering my way. And then also following some of the very, you know, individual teachers, let's say. So I see Sándor and I see Simon, like these individuals. They were walking together for a while. Simon was following Sándor, and then they decided to also go separate ways. But they're still friends. They still, you know, together on the yogic quest. And I find it super beautiful, you know, that they practice with Iyengar together, that they were going together to India. But Simon always says that Sándor is, I think, 12 or 15 years older. So he had he had more time to digest certain things, let's say. You know, this knowledge sometimes sinks in with time as well. As we go along with life experiences, we realize what are we learning in through yoga and how does it reflect in our life. So I see their pathways actually quite, you know, united through the main principles, and then also quite different through the things of how do they portray and how do they pass on their yoga experience. So what I realized I learned through shadow yoga was this feeling of the discipline, of this inner silence. There is no music. There is a lot of silence in the practice and a certain seriousness. You know, I remember going to some workshops and there'll be many teachers in the room. Nobody's using a yoga mat. It's just quiet. You come in and nobody's like chatting there and doing all this like yogic, you know, yeah, we're here at the workshop in London. No, it's just quiet and everyone is very in their own zone. And then when the teacher comes, whether it was Emma, Karen, I haven't met Sándor personally, but I met his wife, Emma, and practiced with her. It was just like 3 days. And even though there are people around you, you just feel like you're actually in your own bubble, let's say. You can just feel those bodies around moving in space and the breath, but you're very much on your own journey. And I really like that, you know. I like that there is this this sensation when you're practicing in the room. The poses very often are not difficult, but they're very challenging because they are being held for a long period of time. You feel like your legs are just burning. Like, imagine if you're standing in Utkatasana for 5 minutes and they're just, you know, saying, yeah, if you come out of the pose, then better just don't come back to the workshop, which some people can find very, you know, strong to hear something like this. But the idea is that if you're there, you're there to do this kind of a deep work and to go beyond the body, which anyways is something that the yogis ultimately aim for, is to, you know, disattach yourself also from the body. Yes, it's your temple. Yes, you take care of it. But also one day we all have to just let it go. Like, we're going to have to let go of the final breath as well. And that's the whole point. Like, are you going to panic when you have to exhale finally?
Yeah.
Or are you going to be in peace with it? So the practice is a preparation for the death.
Yeah, it's strict, from your explanation in a word.
Yes. And there is no space for trivial questions. There's no space for this kind of, you know, like, laughter, I'd say. Actually, what it is about is much more about serious practice. And there's also a lot about nadis, marmas, vayus, all these things that are a little bit put to this, you know, to the side or under the carpet when you look like, let's say, mainstream Instagram yoga. Not many people talk about it.
Okay, let me just give a quick translation for the listeners. Nadi, energy channel, so-called in the Indian system. Marma, a point where these nadi channels intersect, so specific points, there's less than the nadis. And then vayus are five different, I know of five, perhaps you know of more, different
winds that move around the body.
But you know why I'm reluctant to say winds is because of this mass misconception that, oh, prana means air, you know, and it's like, I think that the translation of winds actually helps to compound that a little bit. So rather than winds, I choose to describe them as the character of winds, sort of like characters of energy, maybe. And there's typically five, but the one that you hear most in conventional classes, of course, is prana, which is this, like, you know, the top of the hill stuff without the walk up there.
Yeah.
You know, samana, vayu, you don't hear so much about, but really it's pointed to a lot in the synergy style because there's such an emphasis on the khanda, which is that. Well, I don't know if it's known as a marma, but it's this, the base of the spine region, this energetic channel of the physical body that is Simon claims to be the origin of these many, many nadis, these energy channels, which are referred to in the most commonplace mainstream as numbering 72,000. And of course, that was written on a banana leaf one time and then handed down audibly. And if you read other books on different styles, such as Goswami's Laya Yoga, you'll probably find a different record. Depends on the ancient text you look at. But that's a commonly accepted, the 72,000 nadis energy channels. They intersect at marmas. And then they traverse these five different flows of different forms of energy, which meets. So it's a different, like, anatomical, physiological, energetic system than the Western model, which was, let's cut up a body and, oh, that bit looks different. That's a skeleton. Those bits look different. They look different. They're tendons, ligaments, you know, and then it's just all really reductionist. Whereas the yoga that I felt you allude to, there's a oneness at the top of this mountain, even down to the energetic systems of yoga. They seem to include, you know, lots of different materials in them, you know, so like bones, muscles, ligaments, nerves, blood vessels, lymphatic tunnels, you know, cleansing juices of the body, they'll all be included in one nadi, for instance, you know, or some people have correlated. I won't go on too much about this because I'm really enjoying your flow. And I just wanted to translate that just for the listeners because I'm not sure everyone will know what nadi, marmas and...
Actually, in shadow yoga, they're much more focused on, let's say, these aspects of the practice. They also focus more on the pranayama, but everything is just so subtle, you know, you just... Every movement is an invitation for the so-called guest to flow into the body, which the guest is the breath. It's nothing where you pull or push. It's nothing when you want to grab life or push it away. It's something that you just allow, and it requires a certain way of attention. So once you're attentive to the breath, and you start to observe it, it's still like, how much are you actually grabbing? How much are you pushing away? And yeah, it's basically much more subtle and refined. And what I felt with Simon, for example, is that he wants to bring yoga to many people, you know. With shadow yoga, I feel it's a very specific practice for people that, let's say, are ready to go into this place of discomfort, yeah? While synergy yoga is more like, okay, how can I make yoga accessible to most of the people, most of the time, make a safe practice that many people can benefit from? And, you know, when you even see Simon, he's like this big heart walking around, jumping from one place to another. And he's like contagious with his good vibe and amazing energy and just love. And he's like, just be gentle. I think one thing that I most learned from him it's like how to be gentle and loving towards myself, which is like, finally, you say those things, but you actually feel them with Simon.
Mm.
And even though it's called Synergy Yoga, what I really experienced during Synergy was Tantra.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I really felt a few times when I would be practicing, you know, when you fly with Simon, when you just stand next to him and follow his moves and the clicks and the crazy music. And I even went to Goa to do a teacher training with him. So it was like, you know, the sun is rising, you still hear the beat from Shiva Valley and Simon is with you and you feel like, oh my God, what is this amazing practice? And it took me some time to actually really feel that the movement of the spine becomes something organic, natural, something I don't even need to think about anymore. And then I started to cry, you know, on the practice. I was just like, oh my God, this is it. I'm starting to finally feel it. And that feeling, I think the closest I could, compare it to was Tantra, is Tantra, which is the moment when you realize you're alive, you're buzzing with, you know, this vibrance of the source of life itself, of this life force that we called prana, and you are just so humbled by this recognition. And it's even hard to describe with words. It's just the most amazing feeling. And that feeling was definitely present on many of the Synergy practices. And it's a beautiful practice. I teach it now a lot to my students that are senior, practitioners.
Mm.
I am teaching a group twice a week that are people from 65 till 88. That's my oldest student. And they absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Because it's a practice that is so safe, so accessible, so beautiful as well in itself. You feel the energy flow. I love that it's a mixture between, you know, physiotherapy, Chinese martial art, and yoga. And it just kind of like, it gives me such a big vocabulary of movement, and movement that on top of it is not just a decoration, but it's actually a super backed up by a physiotherapy, nerve tensioning, and you know, Simon, he's a crazy scientist, yogi. So everything, nothing is random, basically. And you feel like, okay, I'm doing these movements. These people don't even understand why they're doing it, but they can feel that it feels good. And they come to you after class and they're just loving it.
Well, so mostly, but
mostly,
I think
yes.
Some people have huge resistance to it. I've experienced that, and I'm a novice teacher with it, you know, so I'm still finding a way to make it land. I
think it's a lot up to the teacher, because I really found that it's for sure. I realized that it does have more resistance if I teach men rather than female.
Mm.
Females, they're kind of like right into it, and it's just like feeling like fish in the water, like, yeah, flow, I love it. For men, it's a bit more like, oh my God, what are we doing? This is spinal waves.
Do you know what, though? Like, I'm on a bit of a mission in the small corner that I have influence to have a little rethink on, like, what masculinity really is. And it's different for me because I'm operating through a male body and, you know, conditions. So, but I really love to access that, like, you know, celebrating men's feminine movement and actually trying to get them into the mindset that if you can move more feminine, you can communicate that feminine essence into the world. And it's a really powerful, and I'll go off track if I start talking about this too much. And I love the fact that you mentioned Tantra as well, but I also, like, I can't give like a quick translation of what that means. If people are interested in Tantra, I suggest you give a few lifetimes to study it, because there's lots of different interpretations of lots of beauty to it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing so intimately on your emotional experience of how it was to be in Goa near Shiva Valley and practicing with those sunsets and referring to Simon as the giant heart. I think that's so prudent as well, because a lot of the science, in his, you know, eccentric, mad scientific way, he used to be a scientist, biomechanist. The structure and the approach is actually quite formalized, in that essence. And you mentioned physiotherapy as well. And I think physiotherapy is something, again, not in the same way as Tantra, but in a same way, it's one of those things that's like, as interpretable system that people can do lots of different things with. And physiotherapy is no guarantee that you'll get better, because a lot of physiotherapists are still kind of still working it out themselves. And I guess that goes back to what you were saying as well about yoga being this really wide field, and it's so hard to find that really potent, authentic, experienced and effective potion of yoga, in that, you know, it's so widespread that, you know, you got to really want and really dig in to get the benefit from it. And why I knew you to be such a magnificent source of this knowledge to remind myself and the listeners was because I can see you, Malva, having done so much digging in so many different fields. And, you know, I just want to celebrate your work ethic for that, and say that it's really magnificent to be speaking with you, because I feel like you're teaching me so much in this. I'm really privileged that you joined me for a conversation, because it's nice to get to know you better. But also, I'm getting a free workshop here that is like one-on-one with an aspiring master teacher. So thank you so much for giving your knowledge and your care to this conversation.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Yeah, there's something about Malva. Malva's energy is you can sense the dedication and just the sincerity, and it's really palpable. I got the sense during our conversation of the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, Maitri Karuna Mudito Pekshanam Sukaduka Punya Punya Vishayanam Bhavana Taschitta Prasadanam, particularly the mudita aspect of this. Mudita being that when you're in the presence of greatness, there's this osmotic sense, this transferable sense that it emits. And this was the excitement that I got in this first half talking with Malva about her interest in shadow yoga and trying to find sincere teachings. And there's a certain dynamism, a certain strength, fortitude that I really took and felt and experienced in the presence of Malva. And then we extrapolate this to some degree into Kalaripayattu, which is this Indian martial art which demonstrates a little bit more of that fire, tapas, and a precious and untainted jewel from the Indian physical canon. You mentioned dancing, and you also mentioned martial arts, Chinese martial arts, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And you also have a bit of experience with Kalaripayattu, although your partner Alex has direct experience of this, is it? Do you have more experience? Or
yes.
Alex? Yeah. And also, you said that Alex studied with Master Yang, who's another of Simon's teachers. Are you happy to share any information on that?
Yes, so basically when 3 years ago, well, almost 4 years ago now, because if you add one more year of practice, I was in a moment where I really was looking for a practice again, you know, when these waves come in your life and you're like, okay, I'm practicing, but I need something. I need to nourish myself. You know, I had a school, I was running it, teaching a lot of classes in a week. And you get comfortable in your self-practice. And at that time, I didn't have any teacher I was following in Barcelona at that moment, and I was just occasionally going to London. So basically I decided to go on the quest to find a Kalaripayattu teacher. And, because I heard already before about this practice from Simon, I read it on different also occasions in different places. And I was just very interested about Kalaripayattu. And so there was, you know, sometimes when you just come up with a wish to the universe, and next week it happens that somebody tells you, yeah, there is a Kalaripayattu workshop in Barcelona. And you're like, okay, perfect. I'm going. So this is exactly how it happened.
High velocity manifestation.
Yes. And I went and I fell in love there immediately. I saw a little bit also about Shiva Ray doing it, and I was just so drawn, you know. And because I see her like the Shakti warrior total. And when I started to practice it, I was so challenged on all the different levels because it was like a mix of everything I did so far, but much more intense.
Wow.
You know, just the warm-up in Kalari, which is called this Lojas, it's just like a complete workout on its own. And it's 15 minutes and you're sweating already. And that's just the beginning, just to get you warm. And then everything you do after, which is like the Shiva, Shakti forms, fire, water. By the time you finished, you feel like you did 6 Ashtanga practices in one go.
Wow. Before you said that, I was interested.
Yeah. But, and then there is so much spirituality in it. Like, you think warriors are just about fighting. And they are, but at the same time, there's so many times you salute and you touch the ground, you touch your forehead, you bring all the intelligence to the heart. There's so much symbolism. There are many mudras. All the movements, they're just so beautiful. And for me, it was like going to the origins of it all. It's the one of the oldest martial arts in our planet. It wasn't and hasn't been touched by the, you know, California crew in the 80s when they all went on a check in India for yoga. And then they transported into California and now we have a yoga soup in Europe.
Yeah, right.
It's nothing like that. You go and you know that it's been maybe, you know, 2 people from away from you that brought it to Europe and they've been practicing with senior teachers in India, in Kerala. So actually my partner is one of those people and we met through Kalari. He was my teacher and then we became partners. And for me, it's just so good to, you know, be in a couple with a person that has such a strong practice because we do understand each other's needs. I love Kalari, but so Kalari is a shorter version from Kalari Payat. But I do see that, you know, especially in your everyday life, it just requires so much commitment that sometimes, well, you just don't have so much time to practice it. And you feel if you don't do it at least 2 times a week proper, you get out of shape and then your body is just sore. So it's a bit like you need to keep up with 2-3 practices a week to really enjoy it. Otherwise, you kind of stay in a square one. Can be a little bit frustrating. So I do practice it, but I don't practice it with such a constance like I did at the beginning. Why? Because I have twins. We have twins with Alex.
Yeah.
Yes. And twins, you know, they have 3 years old now. They are 3 and they consume a lot of our energy. So Alex, he's much more committed to his practice and he really goes almost every day to the forest and does his Kalari. For me, it's a little bit more difficult, I have to say. And also, you know, for a female body to go through pregnancy, breastfeeding, all that jazz, it takes time to get back into your stable practice. Nevertheless, I'm super grateful. Wouldn't meet Alex if it was not for Kalari. So this practice definitely had a big, it was a big milestone in my life.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's so cool to go on that journey with you and to hear the, yeah, really get the sense of the discipline of it. And, you know, would it be disrespectful to call it like an Indian Shaolin discipline, like an equivalent?
So basically, it's not really a Shaolin. I wouldn't say it's not designed for monks. It's actually designed for warriors and then also for householders, you know? Many postures, many movements are taken from the world of animals. So the idea is that your spine is most of the time horizontal to the ground. So you go on very deep squats and, you know, you have poses like lion pose, peacock, fish, but everything is just like more standing. So it's not like in yoga where you lie down on the floor. You need to be really capable of constant movement, jumps, explosive movements, and going really into contraction. And everything is like, yes, there is a big attention to detail, but at the same time, there is a lot of movement all the time because it is a preparation for you to be able to fight. So you need to, the idea is that the body becomes all eyes, and they even call it, they say it like this. It's when the body becomes all eyes. Everywhere you have eyes, you feel everything that is happening around you. You have different weapons. You don't use yoga mat. You move around the space. Originally, it's practiced in a dirt pit, which is 3 steps under the ground which is believed the Kundalini energy resides under the ground a bit, and you're covered in oil. You wear a langoti, which is just a kind of a piece of Indian fabric wrapped around your waist and covering your private zone, genitals. And yeah, it's just a very humble practice. Beautiful. You have a putara vandanam, which is like a putara in the side of the southwestern side of the Kalari, where you salute. And yeah, there's just so much into it, you know. It's very rich practice. And the system itself, it's so well designed, because every warrior practicing Kalari needs to be able to fight, but at the same time needs to be able to heal. So every spot that you injure in the other one, you need to know how to fix it as well. As much as you need to know how to injure, you need to know how to fix it. So it's combined with Ayurveda. It's combined with healing arts. You get the whole part about the massage as well. So when Alex went to India for 2 years, he was in Kerala practicing it. He was waking up every morning doing Kalari. Then he was getting a massage from his teacher. Then he had to learn how to apply the massage, and in the evening he would have another practice, and like this for 2 years, every day.
I remember Simon, how I heard about Kalari Payat is that Simon mentioned it. He'd experienced a little bit of the marmas through it. So it's really interesting that you bring that healing art thing in, and this is something that was really interesting. I was very interested in the bandhas as well, because, you know, in Simon and Bianca's book, they talk about nine major bandhas, which is, as far as I can tell, a classification that they've summarized, but it's based on the traditional teachings of Kalari Payat. Did Alex ever mention to you about the bandhas? Were they ever mentioned in that, in the teaching?
Yeah, so actually when you practice Kalari, you realize that it's very interesting, because it's, especially for yogis, I feel it's a very strong practice, and oftentimes me as a yogi, I would be like, oh no, I can't do this. Maybe I get injured or something. But the approach is just trust, surrender to the practice. You kind of even have to, let's say, break into your body, break into your mind, and just go for it, because you need to become like complete, you know, elastic bamboo body, which means like there is no mercy. You just go for it. And of course, you need to get this practice from a very experienced teacher. And then anything that is blocked in the body needs to get unblocked, so that the energy can really flow through the body. And in that way, the bandhas are also applied through a different way a bit than in yoga, you know. In yoga, we get very, very like, a little bit like, oh, I need to do this, and then this happens, and then I have to hear rap, and then hear
intellectualized.
Yeah, be careful.
Cautious,
and stuff.
Overcautious.
Yes, yes. But in Kalari, it's not so much through the mind as much as it's through the body. And also, as I mentioned before, they use a lot of oils, you know, and the oils are Ayurvedic oils that are cooked and prepared by your teachers, and everyone gets a different oil according to your dosha.
Ah, wow.
Your dosha is like your characteristic from the Ayurveda. So if you have a Vata body, you would get a different oil. If you have a Pitta body, you would get a different oil. So that's also, it's like, that's why I'm saying it's a very much more complete, like that practice where you go through all the different channels at the same time, even the diet, you know. So it's like, it's super complete, you know. And the massage that you get from your teacher as well, your bones, your ligaments, your joints, everything needs to become much more like a bamboo. You are unbreakable. Yeah.
And Ayurveda, science of life, Indian traditional health organizational system.
Yeah, so I see like martial arts, you know, they're just so interesting, because when you look at even Chinese martial arts or any different martial arts, you see the movements not being so linear like in yoga, let's say. They're much more circular, like in Qigong, in Tai Chi. They just, moving this energy flow through the body through a very circular movement. So when I discovered Simon, I was like drawn to it because of this, you know, I wanted to feel what he's feeling, because you, when you're in his presence, you really realize he creates a lot of like energy around himself. And that is the energy that I was interested in, how to cultivate that. And in martial arts, you know, you have this stance where you just stay for like 1 hour without movement and you start to feel so much energy running through your body. And yeah, and when then Simon would always talk so much about Master Yang, of course, you start to be also interested in, okay, well, who is Master Yang? What he's teaching? And Simon would always, you know, call him up and be like, yeah, so this is what I learned from Master Yang, this elbow elbow technique or this movement or that movement. And then you're like, okay, okay. So talking about that and, you know, practicing also with Simon, my partner Alex met Simon and they would exchange a lot of information about Kalari, a lot of things that they noticed along the way. And one day Alex just decided to go and practice with Master Yang when he was in Vienna, and he absolutely fell in love. Yeah. And now he's practicing with Master Yang also.
Yeah. Where is he doing that?
Now he's doing online classes because, of course, during the COVID times, it's not easy to travel, and especially for Master Yang to get out of Australia and for Simon to get out of Australia.
Master Yang's in Australia.
So... yeah, so we're doing, we're doing classes with Simon, five-dimensional course I'm doing. We're doing also classes with Master Yang. We're having like a great time, like a yoga retreat in our house.
Life is a yoga retreat now.
Thanks to COVID, we can practice with all these amazing teachers from all over the world. Yeah, and I'm still continuing...
Funny, isn't it? It's really an upgrade.
Yeah, and I'm still continuing the shadow yoga practice with a great teacher from London called Natasha Nandini. And so I'm having my all, you know, from different sources. Yeah, just a great yogic practice, I feel.
And diverse as well. And yeah, I really respect and appreciate your digging. You know, that bold inner quest to explore, and that you've chosen at the moment these three paths up to the mountain of yoga to connect to it. And, you know, I really do feel that inadvertently you're carrying me with you as you share about it, because some of the things you were curious about, for sure I'm curious about as well. And I'm really happy to be illuminated into your vision of this. So thank you so much, and hope that we get to talk again whenever it is convenient for both of us, because I'd like to hear how it's going in the future with you and how you're integrating these things and your insights. And I'm just curious as well, and hopefully we got a minute before we finish, like, how are you, do you find that you teach shadow? Do you find that you teach synergy, or, you know, any of the influences from Kalari Payat and Master Yang? How do they come through in any recognizable way in your teaching?
Yeah, so actually I feel that, because what I said at the beginning, that to me the most important thing is to be able to deliver a good practice and, you know, give a perfect movement, or a movement that is like a medicine to my students and to myself as well. Of course, I am my own student as well. So this is what I feel, that through all this digging is what I get, is like a rich vocabulary of movement and practice that then can be given to different people at different times of their life and for different use, because they have different needs, you know? So my youngest...
Almost feels like you're tooling up. You've got loads of tools available.
Yes. And, you know, my youngest student right now, it's 13 years old, and she had a suicidal attempt last year. And so I'm actually taking her with the yoga out of depression. And with her, I feel what is working now the most is, for example, synergy practice, where I can just, you know, blast some music. We're going to fly together and it's going to be great. And for her, it's something to look forward in every week to meet me and to have this time together. And it's helping her to get back on track. For a student that I have in United States, a beautiful girl, and, you know, she's a teacher herself. We do more shadow yoga because she's already on that level where she wants to do something that is a bit more challenging. She already did other styles and she wants to look for something that will enrich her practice, you know, but I'm conscious that it's not a practice that I could give to, let's say, a beginner. Yeah. And also not to seniors, maybe. They are in the time of their life that once you go with them to all fours, they don't want to come back up again. they just want to better just lay on the ground. And that's the thing, that the more you practice with different bodies, different people, and they have, you know, all these different needs, the more you realize, okay, what is the yoga therapy? What is the medicine that I can give them based on your experience? And I'm actually very happy that I have this vocabulary, because I know how it felt difficult when you just know one practice. Let's say you just practice Ashtanga yoga, you know, or let's say you just do Iyengar and then you don't know how to bring somebody into flow. So all of this journey so far, even though at times I felt maybe lost, maybe not knowing, you know, which direction to go, right now it actually becomes much more crystallized and much more like, okay, I actually understand what I'm about, where I'm going, what I'm looking for, and then what I can give to others.
Sounds like you've got eyes all over your body.
That's what happens when you have twins.
Yeah,
that's the superpower.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, we started talking about shadow yoga, and as you were speaking on it, talking about the seriousness and the discipline, I started to think of the ascetics. You know, the ascetics were these, like, I understand them to be social renunciates. They didn't lead a monastic or a life of, you know, that going into the ashrams, but they just went out into the jungle or went out into, you know, and they practiced serious austerities, such as holding one arm in the air or standing on one leg or sitting in, you know, impossibly cold or hot, or doing like mad feats in devotion to the divine, to recognize and to show to themselves, their own inner teacher, perhaps, that they are more than the body, because they can, as it were, conquer the body. So I really had that sense that you were alluding to the ascetic yogis who, without even founding California yoga schools, the essence of the power of this magnificent thing we call consciousness, the vehicle was carried so strongly by them. And I think that you're an example of that as well. You know, we used to revere the goddess and the mother and child and Isis and Osiris and, you know, baby Jesus and Mary, because, like, motherhood is such a powerful symbol of asceticism. You know, it's such a tapas practice, a heat generating practice of discipline. Fair enough that you didn't do that much kalaripaya while you were, you know, postpartum. We're twins. So, you know, I'm conscious of the time now, Malva. I want to chat to you for another 24 hours, but we'll spread that out over maybe a couple of lifetimes. And let's reincarnate and do this again. But if you've got time again in the future, I'd absolutely love to hear from you. And I hope to connect with you. I'm going to attend your classes and I'd love to practice with you and to learn and to share all this wonderful knowledge. So
thank you so, so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to meet you as well in the real life.
Yeah,
because it's always different than meeting digitally. And looking forward to share practice, share the insights. It's great that, you know, young people like us can meet like this and to, yeah, just share experiences and learnings and go further with all this understanding about who we are and why we're here.
I hear your kids in the background. They're back from school. It's time to finish. So, you know, the benefit of your practice is something that shines through to others as well. As I celebrate you, Malva, for all the fantastic work you're doing, I too receive some of the benefit of your grace. So thank you so much for doing the work you're doing. And again, thank you so much. And, you know, I just want to finish. Can I do a little chant to finish? You might know this.
Yes,
one. You might
please
want to join in, just in respect of, your enjoyment of mantra and, also the symbolism of it. It's often done at the start of a practice, but Sahana Bhavatu.
Bhavatu.
So should we chant it together? I don't know if that'll work. Okay. Start with Om, finish Om, Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Brunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvi Navaditamastu Mavid Vishavahai Shanti, shanti, shanti. Thank you so much. I trust that the essence of this mantra through the challenge of Zoom still comes through, and that the essence of that intention is shared and goes to its intent. And thank you so much. I wish you lots of love, and I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend. I look forward to connecting with you again soon, Malva.
Thank you so much. Yeah, looking forward to meet you, whether it's going to be on some retreat or, you know, maybe just I fly over sometimes to UK, or you come to Spain or whatever. So yeah,
cool. Yeah,
hopefully we'll meet.
Spain.
Yeah, better come here to the south.
Or India or Australia.
Okay, perfect. Let's go to practice with all these amazing teachers.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of an inner quest that I'm on. Is to connect to teachers that are still around. Before they are gone. There's still this bright lights in the universe.